Tonight, we're going to be talking about feminist critique of science. And to begin with, I think I'd like to explain what I mean by science and then what I mean by a feminist critique. And I suspect that's what I'm going to be doing to end with as well. Because by the time I get through explaining those two words, I'll have just about exhausted my material and exhausted you and exhausted the time. I hope to try and be done in like 35 minutes or so, or 40 minutes, and save some time at the end for some good discussion, because I think this is in some ways can be kind of a controversial subject, or certainly one that not many people have thought about too much, or certainly not necessarily in these terms. So I hope some of the things I say tonight might be provocative for you. First of all, science is, what do you think of when you think of science?
Experiments,
laboratories.
Methodologies,
okay. Nobody thinks of laws of nature?
Test tubes.
You're doing really well. You're thinking of science in terms of the people that are doing the science, it sounds like to me.
Scientists.
And that's one of the first and very key elements of the feminist critique of science, is to take the concept of science off of the throne of some kind of absolute knowledge. I mean, that's what the word science means. Science means knowledge, right? Scientia? Scientia? Something. Scientas? I don't know. What is it in Latin?
Scientia.
So it means knowledge, and yet, obviously, there are more kinds of knowledge other than those that are known by the methods of science. And yet we use that word science, and in some ways, in our culture especially, science has been elevated to have the notion that it is knowledge. And if you really want to know the truth about something, ask a scientist, or you consult the laws of nature. We even use that phrase, the laws of nature, meaning somehow that God wrote them in the sky on the first day of creation, and here we have the manifestation of those laws. They're immutable, they're permanent, they're true, absolutely true. And so the first thing the feminists have done is to challenge that definition of science and to make it more human and to recognize that science is a human enterprise. And so I'm really happy with the answers you all gave. I'm going to read a definition that Evelyn Fox Keller gives. Evelyn Fox Keller has just written this book, brand new, fresh off the presses, called Reflections on Gender and Science. It's a collection of her essays that she's been compiling over the past about 10 years on issues of gender and science. She says, science is the name that we give to a set of practices, methodology, and a body of knowledge delineated by a community and not simply defined by the exigencies of logical proof and experimental verification. What does that mean? It means that scientific knowledge, according to her definition, cannot be defined or verified by logical proof or experimental verification. Now, that part of the definition is different for you, probably, because most people, I think, have the feeling that what scientists are doing is going about verifying knowledge through either rational argument or especially through experimental verification. You come up, you know, with the scientific method with a great big T and a big S and a big M, and we all learned it in high school or somewhere along those times. And the teachers wanted to impress you with it, and they probably wrote it up on the board. I think that's how I got it anyway. Maybe it was because of the era I grew up in, but there was the scientific method, and it was, I've forgotten what it is, actually. There's the three principles, or four, or five, or I'm not sure how many there are. But what they are, roughly, is that the scientist looks objectively at all that's around him, they always said in those days, and then looks for patterns, recognizes those patterns, somehow miraculously, they never say what happens at this stage, miraculously arrives at a theory or a hypothesis, right? And then makes deductions from that hypothesis or predictions from that hypothesis about the way nature must behave in some realm where he hasn't looked. And then goes about testing that hypothesis and finds, aha, my hypothesis is confirmed by nature, or nope, there's a it didn't work according to my hypothesis, and therefore my hypothesis is false. So you verify or you falsify hypotheses. And that's the standard model of the scientific method. You observe, you hypothesize, you test by experimentation. Of course, there's a lot of tricks in all those stages, but that's the basic principle of what the scientist is supposed to do. And a fellow named Thomas Kuhn came along with a book about 20 years ago now, maybe a little more, called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, in which he claims that that's not the way science works at all. We say that it works that way, and that's a kind of a guiding principle for scientists very often, but in fact, and in practice, and in history, in reality, the real scientific community does not function that way. Instead, you cannot ever verify a hypothesis, because all you can do is to show that it is not contradicted. That's the first problem. Okay, you can never verify it. You can never prove it. You can support it, but you can't prove it. Okay. So the best you can hope to do is support your hypotheses. Well, someone else came up with a theory even before Kuhn that said, since you can't support hypotheses, at least you can contradict them. You can falsify them. And Kuhn came along and said, no, you can't even falsify them. Maybe you can, but we don't. Historically, we don't. What happens, at any given time, there's all kinds of evidence, or not all kinds, at any given time, there's almost always some evidence which contradicts any prevailing wide-held theory in the sciences. And despite that evidence, we still hold on to the theory because we don't have a better one. And because we think maybe the evidence is wrong. Or we think maybe something else will come along that'll explain that little anomaly. In other words, it's very difficult to falsify a theory. In fact, many theories, when they were first proposed and first embraced, were in contradiction to the experiments. And so they had to go back and redo the experiments to bring them in line with the theory. I mean, that's just totally unscientific, and yet that's the way it works historically sometimes. Thomas Kuhn, then, was not well-liked by scientists. He's very well-liked by social scientists, and in fact, the book has just sold an enormous number of copies. It's one of the most cited books in the philosophy of science. The reason the scientists don't like him is because he's dealing with the prejudices and the non-objectivity of science. The other prejudice he said was there is, comes even before this point of testing your hypothesis. It comes at the point of trying to look at everything. Now, I guess it's obvious. It's obvious now. It didn't seem to be obvious before Kuhn that you can't look at everything. A scientist is going to have to look at only certain things before he or she makes the hypothesis. How do you decide what to look at? How do you decide what's important, what's worth looking at, what's worth studying, what's worth investigating? How does the government decide what's worth spending your tax money on? Who's going to get the grants? How is the grant money going to be allocated? Should it go to scientists that have a good track record, a long string of successes? Should it go to scientists that are new but have very innovative, creative ideas? All those are social questions, questions that are determined by the society. In fact, let me state that a little more strongly. The scientist chooses which field to work in and what to look at. This is a value choice. It's a choice of priorities. It's a commitment. The choice is influenced by a myriad factors: personal values, religion, friends, spouse, peers, available jobs, available grants, available equipment, doable tasks. I know as a grad student, the general criterion for making a choice of what you would do for a for your graduate thesis work was something that could be done in 2 or 3 years. And if you latched onto a topic that you thought was interesting, but you didn't have any promise of payoff in 2 or 3 years, you were just considered a fool. So we chop up our science into pieces that are doable in 2 or 3 year segments. Or that's certainly true in the publisher perish realm of the professors, not to mention the graduate students, where you want to put out a paper or two every year, and so those papers have to be portioned into just the right size. You can't bite off a big piece. You can't look holistically, because if you look at something holistically and try to get a big picture of the thing, you're never going to be able to publish in a year. So we don't have that old time sense of people devoting 20 years of their lifetime to a project we do still have it, but it's very rare, to a project that may or may not pay off at the end of those 20 years. So you look for doable tasks, askable questions, or you look for where the action is, or you look for where the action isn't, depending on your personality. You look at what's fun or what's apt to pay off in fame or fortune. So there's first a value choice. Then the scientist sees only what he or she can see according to his or her paradigm. Even after you've made your choice of what to look at, you can't see everything. You're blinded, or you're conditioned, your knowledge is conditioned by what will get through your particular lenses, or your particular paradigm, as it's called. And the paradigm in Kuhn's book — Kuhn was the one who kind of invented that term — and it gives a flavor to all the science that you do. A big, long definition of paradigm, which isn't actually Kuhn's, but it comes from an assimilation of a bunch of different people. Paradigm is widely used to mean a worldview or a perception of reality which provides a perspective for understanding and interpreting and responding to everything that we know or experience. And it applies in science as well as in our daily lives. So it may include beliefs, values, assumptions, prejudices, priorities, goals, desires, visions of the future, language is crucial in paradigm, jargon, literature, stories, mythology, theories, mental models, methodologies and techniques. In short, anything which organizes and lends meaning to the perceptions, thoughts, communications, and actions of those people that adhere to the paradigm. Paradigm makes possible communication between scientists. And what happens in science is that somehow, through a very mystical process, one paradigm tends to gain ascendancy in a particular scientific community. And there's usually people outside that community, on the fringes of that community, that don't really buy into that paradigm and practice a different kind of science. They're called people like astrologers or UFO, students of UFOs, or telepathy, scientists studying telepathy, or all these sort of fringe areas that do not rate, in the majority of scientists, the legitimate title of being called sciences. I hope you can say I'm saying that with some sarcasm. So the scientist, once the community establishes a paradigm and agrees upon that paradigm, then everything that falls outside that paradigm is sort of excluded from sight, almost, is not seen or is not considered legitimate practice. And so the paradigm very much restrains and restricts the kind of science that can be done free.
I'm having a lot of trouble listening to this, but I'll myself straight here.
Thank you.
Clear that the good scientist is constantly trying to defeat this mechanism. The good scientist is looking for something that will lead to a new paradigm. You know, that explains all the existing stuff and explains more. And he's looking to see the things that don't, that fall between the cracks of the regular explanations.
Yeah, I think that's an idealization, and there's very, very few scientists that are doing that.
I disagree. I think that there are scientists who consider the same problem for 20 years. In fact, I mean, almost everybody I know has a problem on the back burner that they've been thinking about for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Can't afford to work on it because
that's right. You don't work on it full time. You write up your grants for something else.
Okay.
Right. But it's there. It's happening.
Yeah, that's right. That I'll agree with.
And people are also constantly looking at the things that don't fit in. You know, because everybody wants to make a big discovery. Everybody wants to overturn the current paradigm. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think
That's not true though. I mean, that's true of some renegade scientists, but there's very few scientists that are doing that in our world. Most scientists in our world are basically working as technicians. They're basically doing a routine task day by day. They're not doing the creative kind of work that you're talking about, the fiction that we tell our high school kids to make them excited about science. But I don't think that's what scientists do in our world. And I think there's a lot of good studies to show that. I mean, half of our scientists are working on building better bombs and making better missiles and involved in defense work. Half of the scientists in the world are in defense work. And that's an appalling statistic to me. And of the other half of those are making better cat food and better cosmetics and, you know.
Yes. Yeah, okay, well, maybe there needs to be another name for those people.
They're scientists.
A lot of them are doing engineering. A lot of them are doing I don't know what you call people who are looking for better cat food.
That's applied research.
Applied.
You're talking about pure science.
Pure science. Okay. Even in pure science, when a new theory comes around, the experimentalists or the people who are working in the paradigm, the big incentive then is to try and verify it, not to tear it down. There's a lot of incentive to try and verify the theory because that's how you gain your fame. The new theory comes along, you get your name tagged on to the person who thought of it, and you gain some kind of fame. You can write papers on it, and you're a good scientist. After the theory's been around for a while, then the fame and glory comes from tearing it down.
So but the thing that I think needs to be mentioned here is that this would all sound completely like a bureaucracy or completely dogmatic, basically. Except for the fact that people are constantly rubbing up against reality. I believe that almost every scientist is working with something that either works or it doesn't. You know, that is, if you have a wild idea that immediate X will cause this, plants to grow better, if they don't grow better, almost every scientist will recognize that in fact they are not growing better.
Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is not to indicate that there are no objective criteria for making evaluations. Yes, there are. But at rock bottom, the decisions are not made only on the basis of objective criteria. Okay. There's all kinds of elements of values, choices, and faith commitments and other things working in the process. Okay. But yes, I'm not throwing out objectivity altogether. Okay. Nor are the feminists in their critique of science. So far, I've just cited Thomas Kuhn, who's not neither female nor am I. So what am I doing? I thought this was supposed to be a feminist critique of physics or of science. Let me indicate some of the... So far, I've basically just been concentrating on that side of defining the science. And now I want to look at the other side of my title, which is a feminist critique of sciences. And I want to talk about what a feminist critique means to me. I mean, I'm a man, and so what do I know about feminist critiques? I do feel like I've lived with it for a while. I've talked to a lot of people. I've read a lot of books. I've got a wife who tells me about these things too. I have some students who have been working very specifically on this question of a feminist, female students, working on the question of a feminist critique of science. And I've spent many hours listening to them and listening to their pain. I'll say that strongly. In having grown up in a world interested in science when science is a man's realm, and that makes them very angry. And they want to be able to do science, and yet they've felt systematically almost excluded from that world, or if they were involved in the world, systematically looked strangely at by their sisters, which is also painful. So I want to talk about what I mean by a feminist critique from my male understanding. First of all, fundamentally, to make a feminist critique of anything means to look at that thing through the eyes of women. Now, not all women have the same eyes, and so you look through different women's eyes and you see different things, of course. And there are many women's eyes who, I mean, there's a big overlap between the eyes of women and the eyes of men. But if you try to look at something through the eyes of some kind of stereotype woman, sort of like what we do when we make a third world critique of institutions in our country. Instead of looking at them through our eyes, through the eyes of an American, we look at them through the eyes of a third world person. The poor, with a big P, or the oppressed folks. You know, we don't necessarily have a particular person in mind, although maybe some of us do. In fact, one of the best ways of looking at our world, at the United States, through the eyes of the poor or the oppressed, is to talk to them. Pick out one poor oppressed person and talk to him or her and see what the world looks like through their eyes, or read if they've been in some place graciously recorded in print. That's what you can do to look at science through the eyes of women. And here are some of the things that you would see. One of the first things you see is that there are essentially no women in science. Now, that's not quite true today, and the trends are changing, times are changing, and you can count on your fingers some of the famous women in science in the past, but basically, science has been a male enterprise, very strongly male enterprise. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's been a biased male enterprise, but it makes one a little suspicious. If it's been a field that has been controlled from its beginnings by men, perhaps it would have been a little different kind of a field today had it been equally populated by men and women. That's my first and strongest element of the critique against science. It makes one suspicious. It makes one say, what would this field have been like had it had an equal population of women involved in its creation? Why did it persist for 300 years or 3,000 years in being a male-dominated field? In what ways have the men excluded women from this field? Simone de Beauvoir in 1970 made this nice statement, sort of the theme of this talk. Representation of the world, like the world itself, is the work of men. They describe it from their own point of view, which they confuse with the absolute truth. So here I am giving you the absolute truth about feminist perspective on science. So one of the first critiques then is to question whether or not science is indeed absolute truth. And you can see we've already been doing that in the questioning I've been giving of science and indicating that it is a human enterprise. It's not only a human enterprise, but it's been predominantly a male enterprise. It's predominantly viewed through the eyes of men. I'd like to say a little bit about the history then of that enterprise. One of the founding fathers of modern science was Sir Francis Bacon, and he's an easy target, but I'm going to take advantage of that and read you a few quotes of Sir Francis Bacon. He's called the father of the scientific method. He's the guy who did this thing that I said earlier with the big T and the big S and the big M. He's the one who carved that in stone and said, here's what scientists are doing and will do from now on, and they'll get good science out of it. But old Sir Francis says, the terms in which Bacon advocated his new empirical method of investigation, empirical meaning you do this experimentation, you look at nature, You don't just philosophize about it, you test your ideas. The terms that he used were not only passionate, but often outright vicious. Nature, in his view, had to be hounded in her wanderings, that's a quote, bound into service, made a slave. She was to be put in constraint, and the aim of the scientist was to torture nature's secrets from her. Much of this violent imagery seems to have been inspired by the witch trials, which were frequently being held in Bacon's time. Bacon was actually the Attorney General for King James I, and was therefore, no doubt, intimately familiar with such prosecutions. And because of seeing nature as female, which was very common, has been historically very common, it is not surprising that he should carry over the metaphors used in the courtroom into his scientific writings. Indeed, his view of nature as a female whose secrets have to be tortured from her with the help of mechanical devices, that's again, quote, is strongly suggestive of the widespread torture of women in the witch trials of the early 17th century. Bacon's work thus represents an outstanding example of the influence of patriarchal attitudes on scientific thought. So there was an ancient concept of the earth being female, being a nurturing mother from whom we derive sustenance. And in some ways, this is a healthy image. But that image was transformed in Bacon's time and thereafter also by Descartes and Newton, where nature was seen as almost an adversary, as someone that had to be mastered, stood over, dominated, exploited. That nature did not yield up her secrets willingly just by mere observation. You had to devise experimentation. You had to torture the secrets out of nature to be able to have science progress. Very shortly after that time came Descartes and Newton and those folks who basically lost any sense of nature as organism or as feeling, as sensate, as a woman would be, and reduced nature and the universe to a machine, the cosmic machine. So we have then a dehumanizing, basically, of nature, which may be just as well. I don't know, rather than treating nature as a someone to be tortured. The ideas, though, the mechanistic notions and the notions of dominance and control have permeated throughout Western science and have really influenced the direction that science has gone. That's a statement of opinion, I guess. It's hard to prove that. You could give a lot of examples that this whole book almost is devoted to that subject, The Turning Point by Capra, highly influenced by several women in his life and several feminists that whose elements are very clear throughout that book. The thesis is pre-seen somewhat in an earlier book called Why the Green Nigger by Elizabeth Dodson Gray. I think this has been republished without the word nigger in the title as Green Paradise Lost. I'm quite sure that's the same book. Maybe some of you have heard of that one. And Elizabeth Dodson Gray's whole claim is that we've established a hierarchical way of viewing nature and viewing God. We put God on the top and then man under that and women under that and then children under that and then dogs and cats and animals and the earth and the trees and the plants and the stuff that we walk on. There's sort of this sense that to be higher up on that hierarchy is to be more spiritual. You've arrived or you are arriving and eventually you'll be like God. But it's an upward progression with, of course, men above women. This again, is an attitudinal thing, a value perspective that basically condones the treatment of women as inferior by men and condones the treatment of nature as our domain to be taken advantage of, to be used for the benefit of humanity, for the benefit of man, even. Another book along those same lines I'll just mention in passing, but I won't get into the whole theme of it, is called The Death of Nature by Carolyn Merchant. And if you're interested in that particular aspect of the feminist critique of science, then I'd suggest you're reading The Death of Nature. It's a good one. It's about 1981 or so. Okay, some other elements of the feminist perspective or approach. And these are kind of general elements of a feminist critique that apply in science. They apply in their critique of sociology, of economic systems, of literature, of any place where the feminists are writing in a critical way about some institution in the society. They will use some, or probably not all, but several of these values. And when I direct these towards science, you get particular results. First of all, as you see through the eyes of women, as you look through the eyes of the poor, you look through the eyes of those without privilege, or who have historically been without privilege, who have been oppressed as victim, you start paying attention to power, obviously. And so you see science, if you direct that to science, you see that the power relationships in science are crucial. Science is not just a neutral enterprise, it's being carried on neutrally. It's being carried on especially by the elite, by those in positions of power. Look through the eyes of third world peoples and you see that science isn't something they do. Science is something that's done in the United States, the Soviet Union, in Europe, in Japan. That also should make you suspicious. It's not only done by men, it's done by people, by the rich. Science as we treat it in the world today, it isn't this inherently, but it is in practice, is something that's done by the elite. And it's done, in the process of doing it, power is augmented. The knowledge that science imparts can be used in particular technologies which amplify or aggravate the power inequities in the world. So science does not have the feeling in today's world as being something that's shared or available to everyone. It's a priestly cult that, even though the works may be published, a lot of it's published, a lot of it's not, a lot of it's classified, not published, but even though work may be published, it's published in scientific jargon, so it's still closed to the wider community. It's only available to the esoteric trainees that have bought into the educational system long enough to know the language that's being used. A feminist critique in general will emphasize relationship and connectedness rather than separateness and disjointedness. That's a very big generality, but you can apply that in particular cases, and you can see in the sciences it suggests a new and a different kind of science. The whole thrust of science has been analytical, to divide things into pieces and to try and analyze each part and put them together. A feminist perspective is more holistic, tries to be integrated. This turns out to suggest new kinds of sciences. It would suggest, for example, in mathematics, topology rather than algebra, or rather than analysis. Topology dealing with whole spaces and relationships. It would suggest suggest the whole field of ecology rather than taxonomy, for example. More concerned with relationships among species rather than naming the species and establishing taxonomic hierarchies. I think I'm going to just read through these quickly rather than commenting on each one, because else I'll never get anywhere near through them. Feminist perspective would challenge dividing things into parts, making distinctions, trying to separate, making boxes, drawing boundaries, naming, evaluating, judging, classifying, establishing hierarchies of superiority and inferiority, better and worse, worthy and less worthy, first and last, enumeration. We just love numbers and measuring, and that's become an intrinsic part of what we mean by science. If it's not measurable, it's not science. And that assumption is being challenged. We can now study things like smell as scientists, which we couldn't study not long ago because you can't measure smell. But you can do interviews of people and you can get subjective intuitive reactions. You can deal with subjective feelings and call that science now, whereas not long ago we weren't able to call that science. Getting into theology here, and I'll save that for some other time. So relationship is emphasized, interdependency, connections rather than dichotomies. Any place you've got a dichotomy, you get suspicious about it and you say, why is this a dichotomy? What am I missing? Is there something in between? Is there something outside? Is there something above it? Is there really a boundary there? Is it fuzzy? The whole notion of boundaries is a subject that's very much open for discussion when you start doing a feminist critique. The impossibility of objectivity. Feminist critique will explicitly acknowledge biases from the very beginning and say, rather than always trying to transcend biases and say, ultimately, we're going to try to be objective about this, as the scientists above all try to do, they say, there's no such thing as perfect objectivity. So rather than trying to cover it up and hide it, let's just start right out and state what our biases are. So people, and look at them very clearly and say, this is where I'm coming from. If you pick up a book that is very distinctively a feminist book on some subject or other, almost in the first two or three pages, I can almost guarantee you, the woman usually who's writing it will say where she's coming from, what her perspective is, why, what motivated her to write it, why she thinks this particular topic's important, and what assumptions she's going to be making, what school of thought she's coming from. All those assumptions and biases come in very early in feminist writings, whereas the men will try to say, I'm objective. I'm going to tell you how it is. I'm going to analyze reality as my reality is universal, as Simone de Beauvoir said. So they recognize that science is perspective dependent, depends on how you look at it, what kind of science you get. The author of this book, Evelyn Fox Keller, wrote the book just prior to this one on Barbara McClintock, the Nobel Prize winning woman of about 5 years ago, who did work in genetic structure, and says the way she did science, the way she practiced science, was different than the way the men were practicing science during her generation of practice. She calls the book A Feeling for the Organism, the life and work of Barbara McClintock, A Feeling for the Organism. Barbara McClintock herself says that her most creative work came from getting a feeling for how the genes worked, thinking, trying to put yourself in their place, empathize. Okay, all these qualities of emotion, which are supposed to be outside the realm, supposed to be, I mean, we tell our students when we write the principles up on the board, outside the realm of science. Yet most great breakthroughs in science, most, even men, talking about men now, will say that there's a very strong level of intuition, of feeling, and of inspiration in the science. And it's not as cold and objective and detached and emotional as it's supposed to be, it's claimed to be. So one of Evelyn Fox Keller's premises, theses then, is that we should sort of celebrate this other aspect of science, which is too often downplayed. And she's convinced that one of the reasons more women aren't going into the sciences is precisely because we don't acknowledge that feeling aspect in the sciences, and the sense in which it's a real human enterprise, where it involves the whole person. And instead, we represent science, the men, teachers, represent science as something that's cold, detached, rational, analytic, objective.
Just
the exam. Right, right. It's especially in the phase of figuring out a theory. And it's also in the phase of testing that theory. And that's where that's coming back into science again, under the critique from feminists and from people like Kuhn. Recognizing the limits of rationality, of dualistic thinking, an appreciation for the non-rational, the mystical, the intuitive, the inexplicable, dreams, meditation, paradox, mystery, all words kind of coming in and challenging science or scientific orthodoxy. Explicitly acknowledging social and personal responsibility. This sees the side effects not as accidental, but as essential. Because of this holistic perspective that the feminists bring, they would recognize Three Mile Island not as, oh, that's an accident. The system, you know, we define the system this way, Three Mile Island is just an accident, we'll fix that. They say the Three Mile Island type incident is part of the system. It's going to do that eventually, sometime. It's a natural outcome of setting up that kind of a structure. We have pollutions in our streams. Well, why? Because we spray our crops. Why do we spray our crops? Because we have to, and there's all these vicious circles of use of pesticides and stuff, poisoning the environment. They see those in ecological terms, not just in pragmatic efficiency terms. One phrase I read from one feminist writer on this subject, she says, science should be taught and should be seen as plural and exploratory, not single and explanatory. To teach the exploratory aspect of science, the imaginative aspect of science, and emphasize that rather than always just the explanatory aspect, that here is the answer. The myth of the right answer is one of the things that's being exposed in this critique. The inevitability of science, seeing science the way we've got it today as the only science we could possibly have, because after all, we followed the method and here's where it's led us, and here's what we know about the world. There are all kinds of alternative explanations of the world possible. There are all kinds of different ways of thinking about time, thinking about space, thinking about matter, thinking about people. That you can experience some of those things if you're in other cultures. You can experience, some people experience them on hallucinogenic drugs. There's a lot of different images of reality and ways of dealing with nature as we find it, and that do not necessarily lead to the same road as the Western scientists have developed. There's a different understanding of power. I mentioned that earlier, but I didn't elaborate on it much. Power as seen as power with synergy rather than power over, again, because of the systems type of thinking. Power seen as flexibility and adaptability, again, an ecological or environmental type of thinking, that you see that power in a species emerges not from being well adapted to the environment, but being adaptable to environmental change. That's a different emphasis there. The ability to help others be effective, that's a form of power. Not your own power over them, but a power to enable them. I'm going to quit there. I've got a whole bunch more, but I'm not going to... What have we got, 5 minutes? Okay. I'm sorry. I underestimated how long I was going to take on those things. Yes, Herman?
One thing that I read that fits in with your notion of moving toward connectedness or an organismic feeling of the world versus the separation hierarchical. This was written by a journalist, not by a scientist, and it's in the field of biology. And if there's somebody here who could confirm it, would be helpful. The point of the article was that so much of our understanding about the world of nature is that it is... nature is red in tooth and claw, you know, the old expression about how it's competitive, and mm-hmm. one feeds off of the other and destroys the other, and it's survival of the fittest, and the observation this person made, I suppose it's difficult to verify, it depends on how you weight the death of ants and things like that, but he said that 5% of the deaths in nature are caused by attacks from other, from the survival of fittest. So.
Hmm.
And that 95% of the deaths in nature are very different.
Are natural causes.
Yeah. But his point was that what was done was that these 5%, you can argue about the percentage, I don't know, but that 5% set the tone for and established the model for that whole survival of the fittest notion.
Right.
And his point was that what people like Lewis Thomas and other people are saying about the cooperation being natural and interdependence, people, each one organism needing another, and that whole interconnectedness that you talked about is a much more fundamental reality of nature than the survival of the fittest notion, where each one is trying to destroy the other.
And like you said,
I mean, like a fundamental paradigm difference that matches the sort of description you were talking about, traditional science versus human science.
And the special point of that I want to emphasize is it doesn't matter what those percentages are, whether it's 95 or 5 or what. The point is that we've been looking especially at one side and we haven't hardly seen the other side. And so, sure, this might exist in nature, but so does this. And let's pay attention to this for a while and see what kind of how our science differs when we start paying attention to the cooperative side. There's a whole feminist critique of science education as well that I didn't get into, but that it gets into the whole notion of how we teach science competitively and how we have the grading system and how we work in, you know, we might work in pairs at best in our laboratories, but we certainly don't teach the idea of working together in science. Science is a solo enterprise, and yet in the real world, very often it's research teams that do science, and yet we teach it as a solo star type of thing. Again, it's that competitiveness. The scientific world is very competitive.
I think I have a historical question. I'm interested in hearing you say more about the idea of nature as a machine that you mentioned. I'm not sure I see how that fits into the feminist perspective that you gave us of science as having patriarchal origins and a penchant for hierarchies. Mm-hmm. That the idea of nature as a machine really seems to be a kind of leveling idea, sort of brings everything down to the same level. Like the old idea in 18th century physics of everything, matter being sort of billiard balls bouncing around each other. That's the reality. And everything else is a sort of a reflection on the surface or something like that. And I think also of Darwinian biology, which really reduces man to some kind of a glorified or complicated protoplasm. You know, that idea seems to be a leveling idea rather than a hierarchical idea. And I'm interested in understanding how that idea gained currency, you know, why that became the paradigm that was accepted and still is in a lot of places. If science has these patriarchal origins and this penchant for hierarchy, those two things don't seem to fit together to me. Mm-hmm.